It's 3 o'clock now, so I can begin with today's sutta class. And it's going to be the Potapada Sutta. There are copies on the table, I think, still. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ dhammaṃ saṅghaṃ namassāmi. So today is the first sutta class of the season after the rains retreat. And many of you have been coming to these sutta classes for many years before, usually being a teaching from the middle length sayings, the Majjhima Nikaya. One of the reasons for that is that the suttas, the discourses there, are just about the right length for one class. But we've done all of those suttas and some many times. So today, and for this year, I'm going to try and get some suttas from other places. We thought, first of all, of trying to get some from the Anguttara Nikaya, but those are such short teachings, it's very hard to get one which is long enough. Usually you have to get two or three and put them together and connect them somehow, which is a bit more troublesome. But there's also, the Sanyutta Nikaya is the same. Many suttas, you've got to try and get two or three of them to make a class. But today I wanted to go the next couple of weeks, into some of the suttas in the long discourses, because some of these are some of the best teachings of the Buddha, very, very deep, very powerful, and today I've chosen one of those called the Potapada Sutta. Now it is a longer teaching, and I'm not sure whether we'll finish it today, but it's a strange, strange thing for me, that in November, for some reason, I'm not going overseas. I'm not quite sure how this happened, but it means that I'll be also here in 2 weeks' time for the next sutta class. So if I don't finish today, we can carry on the next time. It gives me the opportunity to do a longer teaching. So that's one of the reasons why I chose the Potapada Sutta. And it's a very well-known sutta amongst the meditators. I remember that the Buddhist nun Ayakema once taught a whole retreat just on the Potapada Sutta. And that's all she did for 9 days, however long it was, every day, about twice, just going through this sutta in meticulous detail. And that's how important it is. So I won't go into such detail as she did, but still into some specific detail. And just to give a little background here, there wasn't just Buddhist monks in the time of the Buddha. There were all sorts of people from, you might say, you know, different religions, but they all shared a common goal into trying to end a cycle of rebirth. At that particular time, the idea of people getting reborn was pretty much the commonly accepted view of most people. And it was also held to be like a world of a lot of problems and suffering. So that their idea was to try somehow end this rebirth, end this cycle of continued coming back again and suffering. And so that there was many people from many different religions, as they say, trying different ways of trying to end this cycle of rebirth. And it's quite likely the biggest of all of those groups was not the Buddhists, but the Jains, who thought that the way to end rebirth was to extinguish all of your bad karma from the past by giving yourself a hard time in this life until you've worked out all of your bad karma. But there was also this group of wanderers who were much more free in the sense that they would invite other people into their groups, talk, discuss, and try and find a way out of samsara. So it's very clear for those of you who read these suttas that the religious life of inquiry, of philosophy, of finding meaning in life was extremely strong in the time of the Buddha. So strong that it was common to find these wanderers, these Jains, these Buddhist monks in all parts of India. So, Giving that as a background, I will now start the sutta. And if you haven't got a copy, again, it's usually a copy on the table. Hopefully we made enough today. Thus have I heard, once the Lord was staying at Sarvati in Jeta's Grove in Anathapindika's park. And at that time the wanderer, Potapada, was at the debating hall near the Tinduka tree in the single hall park of Queen Malika, with a large crowd of about 300 wanderers. Gives you another idea just how many people would be going to such places, and also that the particular building where he was staying was a debating hall. So in those days when you didn't have TV and you didn't have many other entertainments, a good debate was actually very popular. So these people would go there and debate all sorts of things. Then the Lord, rising early, took his robe and bowl and went to Sarvati for alms. But it occurred to the Buddha, it is too early to go into the city for alms. Suppose I were to go to the debating hall to see the wanderer Potapada. And he did so. There Potapada was sitting with his crowd of wanderers, all shouting and making a great commotion and indulging in various kinds of unedifying conversation. And this is standard for what unedifying conversation is, such as about kings, robbers, ministers, armies, dangers, wars, food and drink, clothes, beds, garlands, perfumes, relatives, carriages, villages, towns and cities, countries, women, heroes, street and well gossip, talk about the departed, desultory chat, speculation about land and sea, talk of being a non-being, the sort of things which you will see on the TV when you get back home. But Potapada saw the Lord coming from a distance, and so he called his followers to order, saying, "Be quiet, gentlemen, don't make a noise, gentlemen. That ascetic Gotama is coming," that's the Buddha, "and he likes quiet and speaks in praise of quiet. If he sees that this company is quiet, he will most likely want to come and visit us." At this the wanderers fell silent, which shows for a start that this fellow Potapada was actually quite favorably disposed to the Buddha, that he wanted the Buddha to come and visit. Then the Lord sat down on a Then the Lord came to Potapada, who said, "Come, Reverend Lord, come. Welcome, Reverend Lord. Alas, the Reverend Lord had gone out of his way to come here. Be seated, Lord, a seat is prepared." Then the Lord sat at the prepared seat, and Potapada took a low stool and sat down to one side. And that is usually the respectful way. It's actually, you know, the higher seat would be to the teacher, and a lower seat. And sometimes, especially if you're teaching in public, you want to have a little bit of a raise so that, you know, you can actually see people and people can see you. But if ever you go to Asia, it's always the higher seat is for the teacher and you take a lower seat in most formal situations. And also, always to one side, never directly in front of the teacher. Because I remember sometimes you give talks and the same person, usually a girl, sits right in front of you. It's very distracting if you're giving a talk. You're trying to give a talk and this girl is looking at you with a big smile all the time. Right, so it's very respectful if you can just go a little bit to the left or a little bit to the right. And I can understand why this was a custom in that time. You never sit yourself straight in front. And the Lord said, "Potapada, what were you talking about? What conversation have I interrupted?" And Potapada replied, "Lord, never mind the conversation we were having just now. It will not be difficult for the Lord to hear about that later." So this is just the introduction. "In the past few days, lords, the discussion amongst the ascetics and Brahmins of various schools sitting together and meeting in this debating hall has concerned the higher extinguishment or higher extinction of consciousness and how this takes place." So first of all, it gives you an idea of what they were interested in or what they were talking about. The higher extinction of consciousness. Now, for many people in our world, they say, what on earth are they worrying about that for? Because remember, in this particular time, as in the time, as in our modern time in Buddhist circles, we understand how important this thing, the mind, is. The mind is a forerunner of all things. And to end samsara, it's not a question of ending the body, but ending this stream of consciousness and how the consciousness actually finishes once and for all. So they're looking about what actually is this consciousness, where it comes from, and in particular where it ends. I'm sometimes wondering why it is that, you know, some religions, they put a lot of emphasis on the creation, the beginning of a world, but they don't put any emphasis on the ending of things. It's always about beginnings, creations, but no endings, which I always thought was a bit strange to me. So in Buddhism, we're more concerned about endings rather than how things were created. More concerned about, you know, how this world can come to an end, how suffering can come to an end, and how this rebirth can come to an end. That's what we're mostly concerned with, rather than how it started. So this is what they were talking about, the higher extinguishing, not of the universe, but of this thing which we call consciousness. And for those of you who don't know, the word here for higher is abhi. Abhi, the deeper, more profound, in the same sense of Abhidhamma is like the higher teachings, the deeper teachings, at least that's what it used to be. And the Abhivinaya, which is also used in the suttas, that's a deeper understanding of the training in your precepts. So this is the higher understanding of the cessation of things. And when it says consciousness here, the word is sometimes called perception. And just as these days, you know, when we talk about consciousness, feelings, perception, sometimes even in English they have an overlap. Sometimes we use one word and we mean the other. And that is just the usual way these terms were employed by ordinary people. And it was always the case that the Buddha would use just ordinary language. Would not want to refine it and define it to be so specific. So here they're using sannya, perception, which is usually the third of the five khandhas, use that as signifying the whole of consciousness. Now, if you perceive, then you're conscious. So the higher extinguishing of especially perception and how this takes place. And some people said, one's perceptions arise and cease without cause and condition. When a perception arises, then one is conscious. When a perception ceases, then one is unconscious. That is how they explained it. And it gives you an idea of what they're talking about, if you can get your head around it. They say that, you know, sometimes it just happens, you know, by chance. You can't actually give a cause, you can't give a reason why it starts or why it stops. This thing called consciousness. But somebody else said, no, that is not how it is. Perceptions are a person's self, or soul if you like, which comes and goes. When it comes, when the soul comes, one is conscious. When the soul goes, one is unconscious. And you know, sometimes that's people think that you may go into a trance, become unconscious. People think your soul's gone visiting somewhere else, or some other person's soul has got into you. You can see that there are some connections with some views of perception and soul or self, which we can find in some places today. Another said, that is not how it is. This is an interesting, a fascinating, we have no connection with this today. There are ascetics and Brahmins of great powers, of psychic powers, and of great influence. They can draw down consciousness into a person and withdraw it. When they draw it down into them, they are conscious, and when they withdraw it, they are unconscious. It's as if that there are special beings who can actually bring consciousness into a being and take it away again. As if some magician can take a doll or something and put consciousness into it and take it out again. And others said, that is not how it is. There are deities of great powers, of great influence. They draw down consciousness into a person, they withdraw it. When they draw it down into them, they are conscious, and when they withdraw it, they are unconscious. And that's very similar to the Christian idea of, you know, a single God, you know, putting consciousness into a being and taking it out afterwards. It was in this connection that I thought of the Lord, Buddha. Ah, surely the blessed Lord, the welfarer, he is supremely skilled about these matters. The blessed Lord well understands the higher extinction of consciousness. What then, Lord, is this higher extinction of consciousness? So I had these four little theories here that it's basically by chance you can't do anything about it. It comes and goes whenever it comes, whenever it goes, and there's no real cause, no real purpose behind it. And there is some say that it's your soul or self, and it's the other two are saying that beings, whether it's highly psychically empowered beings in this human world or other beings, control the conscious or unconsciousness of beings. So, what did the Lord Buddha said? In this matter, Potapada, those ascetics and Brahmins who say one's perceptions can rise and cease without cause and condition are totally wrong. Why is it that one's perceptions arise and cease owing to causes and conditions? Now, this is a common thing about Buddhism. We say these are naturally occurring phenomena. When the causes are in place, these things happen. When the causes disappear, then the effect vanishes. This is a fundamental way that the Buddha looked at things, which is a precursor to the scientific method and view of things, finding the reasons, the causes, which create these effects. But where Buddhism was a pioneer was to apply that particular method to the conscious world of the mind, to see that what happens in the mind comes from causes and conditions, not from without causes and not under the power of some other being, whether it's a monk or a nun of great powers or whether it is some deity. And he continues, and this is where we find it very interesting for those people who have embarked on a course of meditating. So one's perceptions arise and cease owing to causes and conditions. Some perceptions arise through training and some pass away through training. In other words, that because there are causes and conditions for some perceptions, you can train to actually create the causes for these good perceptions to arise and train so that the bad perceptions can vanish. So this is actually a training in perception. And many people who read this sutta actually can say that this is what Buddhism is fundamentally about, is a training in perceiving things in a different way so as to end suffering and create a sense of freedom and liberation and happiness. So instead of changing the world, we change the way we look at the world. This is the beginning of what we call self-help, training your own perceptions. So what is this training, the Lord said? And now we go to something which in this long discourses of the Buddha occurs in the first 13 suttas. It's called the gradual training. What is this training, said the Lord? And what is this training? The Lord said, Potapada, a Buddha rises in this world, an arahat fully enlightened, Buddha endowed with wisdom and conduct, welfare and knower of the world, incomparable trainer of people to be tamed. I'd always like to pause on that because there are some people who just will not be trained at all. And even the Buddha couldn't do anything about that. As a teacher, it gives me great solace to remember that even the Buddha couldn't train some people. So I don't take it seriously when people are stubborn. Know the world's incomparable trainer of people to be tamed, teacher of gods and humans, enlightened and blessed. He, having realized it by his own super knowledge, proclaims this world with its devas, maras and brahmas, its princes and people. He preaches the Dhamma which is lovely in the beginning, lovely in the middle, lovely in the end, in the spirit and in the letter, and displays a fully perfected and purified holy life. Interesting, not only teaches it, but practices it. This is what it means here by displays the fully perfected and purified holy life. So if you want to see where this path leads, you look to someone like the Buddha. You see, that's what happens. And then a disciple goes forth out of faith in the Buddha. They practice, the moralities, And a person who has practiced, you know, morality, the virtues, the precepts, and then one is perfected in morality, sees no danger from any side. In this way, he's protected in morality. This full passage can be found in all of the suttas, the first 13 suttas in this, and we've gone through that before, so I won't linger here anymore, except in the passage where it says he's protected from any side. Sometimes we don't realize the power of virtue. It protects you from malicious gossip when people accuse you of things you haven't done, when they say that you're a bad person. If you're a very virtuous person, it does not stick. They say, no, we know this person. He's been a good person for such a long time. He wouldn't do such a thing. And a lot of times, gossip doesn't stick to a person who has shown virtuous practice for such a long time. And a good example of that which comes to mind in the the biography of Gandhi, that he was a lawyer before he joined politics, which is usually the cause for many politicians, but he was a very upright and virtuous lawyer. He would never take on a case if he did not believe he was on the right side. So if he thought a client was actually guilty, he would never defend him. And that was part of his virtue. And except once, there was a guy who actually lied to Gandhi, and Gandhi believed he was innocent and defended him. And halfway through the trial, he realized that he was mistaken. He was defending a person who was actually guilty. And he admitted that. It wasn't a usual thing which lawyers do, but he admitted that, and people said, we all make mistakes. His virtue was so strong that no one could actually accuse him of things. And you'll find that if you have a strong sense of virtue, then you are protected from malicious accusations which aren't true. If your virtue is not that strong, then they'll say, he did this and he did that. We know he's done other things, so it's quite likely he did this bad act as well. Not only that, but your virtue also protects you when it comes to unseen beings. I do spend a lot of time in Malaysia and Singapore and Hong Kong, and there that so many times people think of beings possessing you. And it is common, in my experience, to notice that people who do keep precepts, they do keep 5 precepts at least, and keep them well, or keep even more precepts, you have a power which you cannot see, which protects you from unseen beings, simply because of your morality, your virtue. I know this is not really part of this discourse, but I don't mind saying there was a woman many years ago whose mother came to Perth on a sort of family reunion. She was a Thai girl. Her mother got very sick, put in King Edward Hospital, and the girl was wondering whether this was her mum's last sickness. And there's many things I don't know happened in Perth. There was a medium, quite a well-known medium here in Perth. So she went to see this medium, gave the medium $20. Can you please find if this is my mother's last illness, if she's going to die? And the medium just asked, what is the hospital, the ward, and the room number? And she took the $20, went into a trance, and went into an astral body to go and visit this girl's mum. And a few minutes later, she came out of her trance and said, I found the hospital, I found the room, but I could not go inside. There was a force field around your mother. And the medium says, who is your mother? I've never seen this before. I just couldn't penetrate to find out whether she's going to survive or not. And that's when the Thai girl said, my mother, she's a Buddhist nun. She's been a Buddhist nun for about 30, 40 years. At which point, the medium took back the $20. You should have told me beforehand. People like me can't get close to people like that. And there's a true little anecdote. And the reason I tell it was it's one anecdote amongst many, that when you keep precepts, you are actually protected. You've got a psychic force field around you, for want of a better word. So you are protected on all sides when you start keeping virtue. So paragraph 9 to 10. And then you guard the sense doors. In other words, you don't go looking around for things which will excite you or listen to things which is none of your business. In other words, instead of going out there into the world and getting burnt by the five senses, you keep the senses inside most of the time, only sending them out when you really have to. And after guarding the sense doors, then you suppress the five hindrances, and then you reach the first jhana. And you remain in it. And whatever sensations, it says of lust over here, but that is not such a good translation. It is of sensuality. Because the word lust, especially to do with, you know, boys and girls having sex and that type of desire and craving, the word here is much wider than that. It's thoughts of any sensory delight, you know, with any sort of delightful object of seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting or touching. So whatever sensations of sensory desire that he previously had disappear. And at that time there is present a true but subtle perception of delight and happiness, born of detachment. Now I often use this, as many meditators do, to actually describe in another way how it feels to be in a first jhana state. Now we usually have the standard description which you see everywhere else in the suttas. Here it's slightly different, complementary, not contradictory. And it's a beautiful little description there, saying that any of the five senses and the sensuality dependent upon them, they've disappeared. And in its place, there is a true but subtle perception. This is actually the object of that jhana. It's a perception, a way of seeing, of true but subtle, not extreme, subtle perception of delight and happiness. That is the object, that's what you experience, the delight and happiness, the piti sukha. And it's born of detachment, created by the detachment from that five sense world. And you become one who is conscious of this delight and happiness. That is your perception, that's what you're experiencing. In this way, some perceptions arise through training and some pass away through training. And this is that training, said the Buddha. So this is perceptions of the five senses vanish and the perception of the delight and happiness takes its place. So sometimes people ask me, so what is the jhana? What are you actually experiencing there? This is where the Buddha is answering it very clearly. You're perceiving delight and happiness, born, created by something falling away. Yes. It is sanya, yes. The word, she asked what the word perception is. It is sanya. Sometimes, for those of you who are born in Buddhist countries, you have to be sometimes careful with the way that word is used in your common language, in Sinhala, and the way it's actually used in the original Pali. Because sanya, I know in Thai, it's more to do with sometimes even memories. And it's not really perception, but a lot of time with perception of past things, not really present things. And sometimes you can see how that meaning of that word has developed and developed over many centuries. You can see the link, it's close to the original meaning in the Pali, but not quite the same. Sorry? Sanya is again the perceiving how whenever you have any experience, you only take some aspects of that experience, and that's what's presented to your consciousness, that's what you know, that's how you perceive. So, you know, sometimes in your moods, sometimes you may be in a very happy mood today, and you perceive Ajahn Brahm's talk as wonderful. And you may be in a bad mood, say, oh, this is a lot of rubbish. And that is the work of perception. Sort of, you know, it perceives in one particular way. So this is how one can train that perception. To take away the perception which is always which is associated with your five senses, perceptions of heat and cold, which you probably, now you're aware of, now I mentioned it, but a few seconds ago you didn't perceive any heat and cold, you weren't focusing on it. Now you can. So you can see just how this mind can choose certain aspects and discard others. Now the feeling in your bottom, sitting down. Now you can perceive it. If few seconds ago, you know, you weren't focusing on it at all. It didn't register in your consciousness. So when it registers in your consciousness, that is an act of perception. You can perceive it in one way or another. Is that the nature of perception? It's always partial. Yes, even when you're enlightened, it's always partial. There's just too many things to perceive. No way you can compute all of that. But the difference between an ordinary person and an enlightened person, you don't perceive it through any negative emotion. Nor do you perceive it in a sense that belongs to me, this is mine. And a lot of times, this is what the Buddha says. He says the sense of, you know, me and ownership is a perversion of perception. We perceive it that way, but it's the wrong type of perception. It's been bent in a similar way that on a hot day like today, I'm sure as I go back later on, I'll see many mirages on the road. What looks like a pool of water on the road, but it's just, you know, just the light being bent, appearing like a pool of water, is a mirage. You perceive that, that's true, but you give it a meaning it does not deserve. That is a problem with perception. If you're enlightened, you understand it's just reflection, it's not a real pool of water. You understand this is just the work of the mind, it's not a self. It doesn't belong to me. So you see things as they truly are, without perversion. Of course, yes. The things you're not seeing. You know, you've got six senses, you can't attend to all of them at the same time. Okay, sometimes you're talking about a Tibetan practice where you perceive one thing and another thing, trying to give them equal weight, and then there's a snap, and then you're supposed to see non-self. Sometimes I'm very dubious about these little tricks and fast ways. Maybe it's because I'm old and traditionalist, but I always like the old well-worn road of the Eightfold Path. If it ain't the Eightfold Path, it ain't good, basically. So sometimes, in all sorts of people, giving you the quick way to enlightenment. No, it's spontaneous, not an act of will, but sometimes that sort of dissolution of one particular way of looking at it doesn't always create this non-self idea. You can create all sorts of other dissociations which, you know, people like you will have to deal with afterwards. You know, sometimes it's a bit of craziness. So that's a dangerous path. In my word. Yes? Yeah. Exactly. Exactly. I mean, the same way with even in some Theravada or Mahayana, I always want to have a fast way. This is a quick way. And please, you know, every time I've taken a shortcut, I always ended up taking longer time. People know it's a quick way to get back to monastery. And, you know, if you take that, and it's not the quick way, it takes a long, long time. So it's not just Tibetans, it's everybody. Always wanting the quick way. The quick way to get rich. And you know what happens to people like that. So anyway, they're just going to about the idea of perception. So this is the first jhana. And the important point of it is that one perception has vanished, another one has arisen. It's a training, in one sense, of perception. And the whole of this meditation is a training in your perception, taking away the perceptions of, say, past and future, and putting it onto the present. Training your perception to see things another way. Taking away your perception of the world through thinking, to a perception of and knowing without giving things names. a different type of perception. Training from that of perception of being all over the place to a perception which can focus on something like the breath with ease. And seeing the breath change, the way you perceive the breath. The whole of the path of meditation, and this is one of the great things about this sutta, is actually changing the way you perceive. A training in perception. Okay, so we go further on. Again, we go through the other jhanas now. And a monk with a subsiding thinking and pondering, that's a movement of the mind, by gaining inner tranquility and unity of mind, it's inner confidence and unity of mind, reaches and remains in the second jhana, which is free from any movement of the mind, born of, and again, not concentration, as I've been saying for a long time now, born of stillness. So whenever you see concentration, please replace that by stillness, and you'll have a far deeper understanding of the original meaning of these texts, and it becomes richer and more consistent. It's born of stillness, where the mind is not moving anymore. The words here they have for moving was like vitakka vichara, here called thinking and pondering, but no one these days takes it to mean that. This is when the mind doesn't move anymore and is full stillness. The reason there's stillness there is because of this confidence. Here says tranquility. The confidence that you don't need to do anything. You can truly let go. And the former true but subtle perception of delight and happiness born of detachment from the five senses vanishes. And at that time there arises a true but subtle perception of delight and happiness born of stillness. One perception disappears, another one arises. And it doesn't have to, like many people sometimes ask, to go from the first jhana to the second jhana. Do you have to get out and then start again and go into the second jhana? It's just one perception vanishes and disappears, another one appears. So the first jhana changes into a second jhana. You don't have to go out again and then go back in. So at that time, in this way, some perceptions arise through training and some pass away through training. Paragraph 12, after the fading away of delight, you dwell in equanimity, mindful and clearly aware. Experiencing the body means not the body is not there anymore. This is a idiom, which means personally experience. It does not mean, say you experience it with your own body, with your own mental body. It's your experience. It's not a theory anymore. It's not someone else's experience. What we would actually call these days direct experience. So you directly experience that pleasant feeling of which the noble ones say, happily dwells a person of equanimity and mindfulness. And you reach and remain in the third jhana, the former true but subtle sense of delight and happiness born of stillness vanishes, and there arises at that time a true but subtle sense of equanimity and happiness, and you become one who is conscious of this true but subtle sense of equanimity and happiness. In this way, some perceptions arise through training and some perceptions pass away through training. Again, with the abandonment of pleasure and pain, the physical part of pleasure and pain, which has gone a long time ago, disappearance of previous joy and grief, which is the Pali words for mental happiness and mental suffering, you reach and remain in the fourth jhana, a state beyond physical pleasure and pain, purified by equanimity and mindfulness. The former true but subtle sense of equanimity and happiness vanishes, and there arises a true but subtle sense of neither happiness nor unhappiness. And you become one who is conscious of this true but subtle sense of neither happiness nor unhappiness. In this way, some perceptions arise through training and some pass away through training. And again, by passing entirely beyond bodily sensations, by disappearance of all sense of resistance, by non-attraction to the perception of diversity, seeing that space is unbounded, instead of infinite, unbounded. You reach and remain in the sphere of infinite space. And the best way to describe that is a simile which I used in happiness through meditation, otherwise known as mindfulness, bliss and beyond, are those people who can experience the present moment in their meditation will notice that time has almost vanished. You can think that there's hardly any time there at all because you're right in this moment. You can't measure it in seconds or minutes. There is no time. But nevertheless, the experience of being in the present moment is being like timeless. You've got all the time in the world. So it is a confluence of these two perceptions of infinite time and no time at all. It's like time being beyond measure. Now this is what they really mean by infinite space. Now don't think of infinite space as like being able to experience the whole universe right to the furthest galaxies. And that's not what it's meant to be. It's meant the whole idea of space is actually about to lose its meaning. No space and infinite space coming together, like no time and all the time in the world coming together in the experience of present moment awareness. And I think from that, it's an experience which many of you have had, present moment awareness, all of you I hope, and that gives you a key from an experience which you've had to understand these first two of the immaterial states. Yes, Chris, you had a question? Dramatic? Yeah. Good. Again, sometimes the whole idea of language is actually connect experiences, connect perceptions from one which is weird to one which is quite common to you. So from the one, you can just take that little step to understand the second. So say infinite space. It's like unmeasured, unbounded, unmeasurable is that concept now. It's neither there nor not there. Okay. So, and again, this is a perception. This is a beautiful thing about this sutta here. It's focusing on one perception vanishing, another perception arising. This is a perception. So it says here, the abandonment of... the number 14, sorry. It reaches and remains in the sphere of infinite space. In this way, some perceptions arise through training and some perceptions pass away through training. So that's a perception, similar to the perception of present moment. No time and infinite time. No space and infinite space. And now the perception of all that space is about to disappear. And then when that goes, the only thing left is the perception of consciousness. By passing entirely beyond the sphere of infinite space, seeing that consciousness is unmeasurable, immeasurable, neither infinite nor not there at all, just like the present moment. No time, but all the time in the world. No consciousness, but all the consciousness you could ever want. You reach and remain in the sphere of, I prefer now, unmeasured consciousness. In this way, some perceptions arise through training and some pass away through training. Now, please also remember that, just going back to Chris's suggestion, thinking this means being able to observe the whole of the universe, that is a very diverse perception. You know, it's stars, galaxies, it's too much stuff there to be a very refined state of meditation. All of these states of meditation have been incredibly profound and also singular, one perception, not with a perception with different aspects to it like space has, but a disappearance of space, not an infinite consciousness in the sense of everyone's consciousness being absorbed into just one single thing, but a sense of almost consciousness vanishing, the very idea of time vanishing in present moment awareness, in the same way the very idea, perception of consciousness about to vanish. And from that, one perception has disappeared, another refined perception has arisen. And hopefully you can see that the the departing, the vanishing of many perceptions is the key. Because when one of them vanishes, it reveals, you know, something more profound. A lot of our life, our conscious experience, is dominated by very coarse perceptions. And when those coarse perceptions of, say, noise disappear, then we can actually have the more subtle perception of silence. We can't have that when these other perceptions are dominant. So when one of these vanishes, other ones come up. Okay, you can go on. I wouldn't call it.
It's actually quite a fast thing, but actually yeah. The sense of immediacy about it and the sense of it coming from the light of the element of
the air. Yeah, coming from within is a reasonable way of looking at it. I know a long time ago that you went on holiday somewhere and you brought back some of those Russian dolls for me. Now that is a much, you know, where one doll is within the next doll. You open it up and there's another door looks exactly the same inside of that. Now that is a much better analogy for what's happening here. Of course, the outside door disappears and you find out what's within it. So in a sense, yes, every more refined perception is within the coarse one. So when the coarse one disappears like wrapping paper, you can see the present within. Present being like a gift. Infinite consciousness. Okay, paragraph 16. Again, by passing entirely beyond the sphere of infinite or unmeasured consciousness, seeing that there is nothing, you reach and remain in the sphere of no thingness, which is a really weird, nice thing to be aware of. Nothing. And you become one who is conscious of this true but subtle perception of no thing. Remember, space has disappeared, consciousness has disappeared, and so what you're aware of, not space, not consciousness, nothing, but you are aware of it. So it's a subtle perception. When one thing disappears, something more refined happens. In this way, some perceptions arise through training and some pass away through training. And that is a training, said the Lord. Now, for those of you, that's the end of the meditative attainments. Do you all realize there was one missing? What's the, you know, the fourth immaterial attainment? What's it called? Sorry? Yeah, neither perception nor non-perception. That's why it's, you can't put it into this framework, because it's one perception as there is and one perception disappears. And neither perception or non-perception is on the edge. You can't really call it a perception anymore. So that's why it doesn't fit into this scheme of the Buddha here. So he consciously omits it. It's not a mistake, it's omitted. And we've got paragraph 17. Pota, Pada, from the moment when a monk has gained, what it has here, the control perception. Actually, what it really says in the Pali, I know the person who did these long discourses of the Buddha, Maurice Walsh. Now, he was a good friend of mine. He was English, very eccentric. He was actually a German scholar who worked for the British decoding the secrets of the Germans during the Second World War. Very interesting life he had. And he became a very devout Buddhist and used his linguistic skills to do one of the first translations. And he did a pretty good job, but here when it says the control perception, it literally does mean sort of a perception of inside. Now, in a sense, what we might call self-perception, but taking away the idea of a soul, like retroflex perception. Instead of perceiving outside, turning that perception in. Sakasanyi. Personalized perception, if you want to call it that. So not control perception, that was not a really good translation there. A saka sanyi, someone who perceives themselves. No, without the sense of me or mine, but the self in the sense of you're looking into inside rather than outside. When the monk has gained this self-reflective perception, that's none of the words I've found which are very good, but reflective, no, that's self-perception is the only way you can really call it without thinking this is seeing a soul. When a monk has gained this self-perception, they proceed from stage to stage until you reach the limit of perception. And that's the limit of perception here, which is perception of nothing. Because when that disappears, when that perception vanishes, you go to the ephemeral world of the last of the immaterial states, neither perception nor non-perception, and from that total cessation. So, the limit of perception. When they have reached the limit of perception, it occurs to them, mental activity is worse for me. Lack of mental activity is better. And mental activity literally means any work of the mind at all. So this is where, basically, you stop willing, you stop perceiving any work of the mind is seen as being a hindrance, even perception itself. What, and again, this is a very good sutta, but some of the translations are missing. If I were to think and imagine, if I were to, literally the first word think is work the mind. In other words, intend. It's called Chaitanya, very much connected to Chaitanya. And imagine is this beautiful word, Abhisankara, which means to intend, to make, to literally to fashion things, to make them happen. So not thinking and imagining, that's far, far too coarse a translation. If I were to, again, work the mind in, and intend, what I call, if I were to do anything. These perceptions that I have attained would cease and coarser perceptions would arise in me. He's going into very refined perceptions, knowing that they were impermanent. As soon as he does something, they will all fall apart. So they neither intend nor fashion anything, and then in them just these perceptions arise, but other coarse perceptions do not arise. You attain cessation. That's where the perception totally finishes. And that potapada is the way in which the cessation of perception is brought about by successive steps. So the Buddha is answering this question about the higher extinguishing of perception or the higher cessation of perception by these experiences of deep meditation. This is how cessation stops. Cause and effect, and this is how that cause creates the effect stage by stage. What do you think, Potapada? Have you heard of this before? No, Lord. As I understand, the Lord has said, Potapada, from the moment when a monk has gained his self-perception, he perceives from stage to stage until he reaches the limit of perception, he attains cessation, and that is the way in which the cessation of perception is brought about by successive steps. That is right, Potapada. So the Potapada is really a bit stunned by this, as we'll see later on. Lord, do you teach that the summit of perception is just one, or that it is many? I teach it as both one and many. Lord, how is it one and how is it many? According as you attain successively to the cessation of each perception, so I teach the summit of that perception. Thus I teach both one summit of perception and also teach many. And I understand as saying that each one of these are like summits, like you go into a mountain range, you climb up one peak, and then you realize there's another peak after it. Because every one of those experiences in these deep meditations, they are like summits. Many people feel that there can't be anything higher than this. It's a summit. But then afterwards, perception vanishes and another perception arises. You realize, well, you have gone to another summit. So I think that's how I understand it, that the experience of each one of these things is a huge summit of perception, But there's another one coming later. Lord, yes, go on. Oh no, no, no. It is just this whole attitude. It is of as soon as they get onto this path of actually basically looking within, perceiving just, you know, what's actually going on inside this thing, we should call it myself, instead of actually perceiving outside. When you start meditating, and you develop that skill to keep perceiving inside things, rather than sending your perception outside. Paragraph 20. Does perception arise before knowledge, or knowledge arise before perception, or do both arise simultaneously? Perception arises first, protoparta, then knowledge, and from the arising of perception comes the arising of knowledge. And one knows, thus conditioned, knowledge arises. In this way you can see how perception arises first and then knowledge, and that from the arising of perception comes the arising of knowledge. Now that may seem a sort of an obvious thing. Whatever you perceive, you know, gives you the bricks and mortar, you know, which make up your knowledge. But it's also very powerful to know that perception conditions your knowledge, and because many perceptions you have are limited, you haven't perceived much of this world, therefore your knowledge is restricted. All our knowledge is restricted by the limits of our perception. So a lot of times people go on and say they know this, they know that. That is true as far as the perception goes, that is true. But sometimes our perception goes far, far deeper, and that changes our knowledge. The old simile I have of the limited perceptions of the tadpole can never know what water is. But then when the tadpole becomes a frog and jumps outside of the lake, then it has some new perceptions. Perceptions of the absence of this thing called water. And that will be the cause for the knowledge of what water is. So that is why that sometimes we need to train with some of these really strange and weird perceptions, the true but subtle perceptions inside these deep states of meditation, for knowledge to truly arise. Knowledge does not arise through thinking. It arises through having perceptions, seeing things in a different way. That's why you can listen to this talk. It doesn't give you a rise to knowledge, but if you perceive things in a different way, then knowledge arises. Okay. Yes. Yes. I cannot help but say that you began that little question by saying they've just found out recently. They found out 2,500 years ago, Chris. Okay. Sorry, I couldn't resist. Okay, so what we got? Okay, now paragraph 21. Now we go into this idea of identifying any of these perceptions as my soul, myself. Lord, is perception a person's self, or is perception one thing and self another? Now, he said, what do you mean by a self? Well, Potapada, do you postulate a self? Yes, or let's call it a soul instead of a self. Well, Potapada, do you postulate a soul? Lord, I postulate a gross soul, material composed of the four elements and feeding on solid food. In other words, my body, my life. But with such a gross self, Potapada, perception will be one thing and the self another. You can see that in this way. Given such a gross self, certain perception would arise in a person, other would pass away. In this way you can see that the perception must be one thing, the self another. The gross self, the body, stays, but one perception comes, another perception goes. It cannot be the same. So, you know, if you say the soul is my body, sometimes the body is there, other perceptions, they come and go. So, you know, the body cannot be perception. The self must be different than perception. Is that okay? Is that clear? Because if it's the same, if the gross self is your soul and soul is perception, when perception changes, your body must change. So it can't be the same. So, I mean, that's a pretty obvious. Nobody these days thinks that their body is themselves, except when they get told by the doctor they're going to die. I'm going to die. You're not going to die. Your body's going to die. If any doctors here, if you have to tell someone that cancer is incurable, please don't say you're going to die. You say, oh, your body's going to die. You're going to get a new one soon. Isn't that much better when you tell your patient? So, you know, oh, you know, you've only got 3 months, not 3 months to live, you've only got 3 months in this old bomb of a body. You're going to get a new one soon. Wouldn't that be wonderful news? Yes, I'm going to get a new bottle. Instead of saying, you're going to die, you've only got 3 months to live. They've only got 3 months to go on holiday to heaven. Okay, I think I'll put that point too long enough. So, paragraph 22. So Potipa says, okay, fair enough, my body can't be myself. I postulate a mind-made self, complete with all its parts, not defective in any sense organ. Now that is what we call like the astral body. And the reason he's saying that is because many people, either they can do that, you know, well, not many people, but some people can just do that through meditation or other practices, you know, leave their body and go astral traveling or whatever. Some people try and do that through, what's it called, lucid dreaming, similar sort of stuff. Or anyway, people will have a similar experience when they die, floating out of their body in what's called an astral body. And that's, you know, that's what we call here mind-made body, perfect in all its parts. Another little anecdote to brighten up this talk. There's one of the old friends. He was a builder. He had a friend who was a builder in Kalgoorlie. And the poor fellow in Kalgoorlie, he got cancer. He brought him to see me at Bodhinyana many years ago, gave him a few teachings to help him, but eventually he died. And the fellow over here in Perth, you know, when he heard his mate had died in Kalgoorlie, he got on the first plane he could. But by the time he got there, the coffin was closed, and the wife wouldn't open it anymore. So he went to the funeral service, and after service, you know, I think stayed a night, then came back to Perth. And a couple of days afterwards, in his home, which is Bull Creek, I think, he woke up in the middle of the night because his wife had elbowed him. For those of you who are married, apparently it happens quite often. And he turned around to sort of tell his wife off for waking him up. But then he realized his wife was fast asleep and the elbow had come from the other side of the bed. So he turned around and it was his mate who had died as a ghost. He saw him there really clearly. And so immediately he turned around to his wife to wake her up. And then when he turned back in, he'd gone. And he thought he was, it's really ridiculous what people do. He thought he was in the house somewhere, so he got out of bed and went through all the rooms searching for him. You don't see a ghost that way. They're not hiding in some other room, either they're there or they're not. But what was really weird, you know, this builder in Kalgoorlie was an Australian, would always, forever be wearing sort of thongs, you know, shorts, and a singlet. But now he was wearing a suit with a polka dot bow tie. And he said, this is really weird, because never in my life have I seen him wearing stuff like that. And so he came to see me, and I said, well, look, who knows? Next time, you know, you want to call up the widow, you know, what do you do now? Are you doing all right, everything okay for you, anything I can do? Because it's a close friend. I say those words, and then just ask her in passing, oh, by the way, what was he wearing in his coffin? And of course, you know what happened. You know, he came back and he said, Ajabram, it's amazing. You know, I asked her that, and she said he was wearing a suit and a bow tie. And she said, why did he never wear that in his life? I bought it for him. He would refuse to wear it. But I thought one last time in his coffin, he's going to wear a proper piece of clothing, a suit and a bow tie. And he, no way he could expect that. And that's how this guy appeared to him, as he was dressed in his coffin. So if you are a ghost, that's how you appear, as you're dressed in your coffin. So there is a reason for dressing up properly in your coffin. Because if you come and manifest to someone, that's how they will see you. Anyway, because that's what we call the mind-made body. You know, it's that body with the clothing you're wearing at the time, it seems, that's how you appear. So I say, that's myself. I postulate a mind-made self complete with all the parts not defective of any sense organ. But again, with such a mind-made self, same argument, perception comes and goes. So when the perception comes and goes, does your mind-made self come and go? And that's pretty constant. So it can't be the same as yourself. Okay, Lord, I have assumed a formless self made up of perception. Now that's a much more interesting thing. A self made up of perception. And the Buddha actually doesn't argue this. With such a formless self, perception would be one thing and self another. If that is really your soul, made up of perception, what he's actually saying there is perception is always changing. So this thing of soul is always changing. It's not the fundamental thing which is permanent, unchanging, the essence. It's just changing. So, then the poor Potapada, but Lord, is it possible for me to know whether perception is a person's self or whether perception is one thing and the self another? Potapada, basically Potapada's really doesn't understand what to do next. It is difficult for one of different views, a different faith, under different influences, with different pursuits and a different training to know whether these are two different things or not, self and perception. So basically the Buddha's saying, well, you know, you need a bit more training. So he starts to ask these other things. Well, Lord, if this question of a self and perception is difficult for one like me, tell me something easy. Is the world eternal? Only this is true and the opposite false. Potapada, I have not declared that the world is eternal and that the opposite view is false. Well, Lord, is the world not eternal? I have not declared that. Well, Lord, is the world infinite, not infinite? I have not declared that either. Well, Lord, is the soul the same as the body? Is the soul one thing, the body another? I have not declared that the soul is one thing and the body another. Well, Lord, does the Buddha exist after death? Is only this true and all else false? I have not declared that. Well, Lord, does the Buddha not exist after death? Both exist and not exist after death. Neither exist nor not exist after death. They're very good about every possibility. Either or, both or neither. Or neither nor. Yeah. Yeah. Yes, yes. Ah, great. The world is infinite, on it. Is it the bread and butter of physicists? The shape of the universe, yes. Yeah, is it infinite or not infinite? This is, again, it's undeclared by the Buddha for a good reason. You know, you must have been like me as a kid. You wondered, you know, this universe, you know, if it's got an ending somewhere, you know, what is at the ending? Is there a big wall around this universe saying, you know, no one can pass by this wall? Or is it like a barbed wire fence with signs? People get shot by God if you go past the end of the universe. You know, that's what they have in Singapore. And what can it actually be? And of course, you know, the answer was, you know, that this universe is curved. It's got a certain size, a certain volume. Ask any physicists and they can tell you what the volume of this universe is. But it's got no edges. So how can you have a certain volume without an edge around? And it's because your perception needs to be changed. One perception has to vanish and another perception has to arise to comprehend this. And the usual thing which you're taught is imagine the surface of a football, you know, one of the round footballs used in soccer, and an ant going on that surface. It can go on forever. There is no wall, there's no boundaries, there's no sign saying, ant, you can't go any further. So in that sense, it's infinite. You can go wherever you want, and there's no end to it. But it's a certain area on that football. know, was it 4 pi r squared, the surface area of a ball? There you go. And you can get that perception of the surface of a ball having an infinite area, in the sense you can go round and round, but it's actually a certain size area. In one sense, infinite. In another sense, finite. So even this universe, the size of this universe, you know, you can't say it's finite. You can't say it's infinite. It has no edges, but it's got a certain size. No boundaries, but limited. He, he, he. And that's the truth of things. So the thing is, the perception, you know, when you ask these, is it finite or infinite? They're asking the question from such a limited perception, they'll always get the wrong answers. When you expand your perception, and that's what life does, you start to see things from different ways and realize, hey, now you can answer the questions. The conundrum can never be answered through thinking. Expanding the perception, seeing things from a different angle, ah, now I can understand. Make sense? I was like, about time. Is time infinite? Or is time limited? What is time? Da, da, da. And it's great in Buddhism, they have all these deva realms, where all these deva realms have different perceptions of time. And it was wonderful that when you went to learn science, you find the faster you go in like a velocity, then time starts to really change. You've got the great experiment, which is could be done, you know, if we could somehow accelerate a human being evenly instead of accelerating one point of them and allowing the rest of the body to actually go at the same. In other words, when you go in a car, your back is being pushed. And because your back is being pushed by the seat, then the whole of your body also goes forward. But if you could somehow get every molecule in the body to be accelerated at the same rate, a different way of accelerating things, then you wouldn't have this terrible squashing or feeling of pressure in one part of your body. You'd be accelerate whatever speed you wanted without squashing or harming the human body. If every molecule could, you know, be somehow accelerated evenly. And then you go as fast as you like. And even you can go to, say, Alpha Centauri, I think it's about 5 light years away, is it? 5 light years, nothing can go faster than the speed of light, but you can get to Alpha Centauri in 5 minutes if you want. You can go so fast, you can get to the furthest of stars within an hour. But when you come back, you find that maybe 10 years has passed, but for you only 10 minutes. Now that is a great thing about, this is just ordinary relativity, of how your perception of time needs to be bent according to reality. One person's perception of time is not the same as others. Please tell that to your boss when he thinks you're working too slow. Yeah, and also strange perceptions too. Because that's why sometimes, say, insight is a function of perception. Sometimes our perceptions are so limited. And because, you know this is the thing with education, you should have a liberal education to widen people's ways of seeing the world. Not just, you know, what they see, but how they see it, so that they can get a greater insight into the nature of the world. You notice that if ever you go to different cultures and see that, you know, they're just seeing things in a totally different way. Their perception is different, which is one of the reasons why they have different values and different knowledges. And the great thing of our modern world is sometimes we can actually meet different cultures and see things through the world of a different language, the world of a different perception. Training perception, yes.
Is that facilitated by stillness and meditation, or the higher package deal?
Is that facilitated by stillness or by the higher package deal, this training of perception? It's both, because stillness is the proximate cause, It's a real cause which makes other perceptions arise while some disappears. But you can't have that stillness without the rest of the package. Yes? Tathagata is because in other suttas, you know, he says that, you know, people sometimes say, well, you know, if there's nobody there, why do you say I do this and I teach that? And so because of language, that we always have to use the word, you know, I am now going to serpentine, you know, I am going to go to the toilet. Because we use that word I, the Buddha used a Tathagata as just as a skillful means of getting away from anyone being confused. You know, just Tathagata, the thus gone or the thus come. Usually the thus gone to nothingness, basically. So that's, you know, how the Buddha would describe himself. Now, you have lots of fun with these words. You know, in my retreats, people kept on asking, how should we address you, Ajahn Brahm? You know, Ajahn Brahm, I said, no. I used to use recently, up until about 6 months ago, you know, you can call me His Emptiness, Ajahn Brahm. But then I decided a much better word was His Roundness. So when you take away the sense of self and me and I, so the Buddha had to use some sort of word, you know, to try and escape or teach, you know, that when, you know, he was teaching, referring to himself, he wasn't referring to himself as a me or a mine or something. So I used that word Tathagata. I think all Buddhas would use similar words. Could have been, because, you know, the Buddha, you know, remembered that past life under Kassapa, the Buddha. So it could have been Kassapa used that word, I'm not sure. But it was just another word which he used to describe himself. Okay, now where are we? We're at... Oh yeah, about these questions. Paragraph 28. But Lord, why has the Lord not declared these things? Potapada, it is not conducive to the purpose, not conducive to Dhamma, not the way to embark on a holy life. It does not lead to disenchantment or fading away, dispassion to cessation, to calm, to higher knowledge, to enlightenment, to Nibbana. That is why I have not declared it. So, you know, those perceptions are the ones which don't lead anywhere. But Lord, what has the Lord declared? Potapada, I've declared the Four Noble Truths. This is suffering, the origin of suffering, the cessation of suffering, and the path leading to the cessation of suffering. Why has the Lord declared this? Because, Potapada, those four things are conducive to the purpose, conducive to Dhamma. It's the way to embark on the holy life. It leads to disenchantment, fading away, cessation, to calm, to higher knowledge, to enlightenment, to Nibbana. That is why I have declared it. So it is, Lord, so it is, Welfarer. And now is the time for the Blessed One to do as he sees fit. Remember, the Buddha was just passing by on the way on arms round. So now he had to go and collect his lunch. So it is, Lord, so it is, Welfarer. Now is the time for the Blessed One, Lord, to do as he sees fit. And then the Lord rose from his seat and went away. This is a passage I always like in the sutta. Then the wanderers, as soon as the Lord had left, reproached, sneered, and jeered at Potapada from all sides, saying, whatever that ascetic Gotama says, Potapada agrees with it. So it is, Lord. So it is, Lord. We don't understand a word of the ascetic Gotama's whole discourse. Is this world eternal or not? Is it finite or infinite? Is the soul the same as the body? Does the Tathagata exist after death or no, or both or neither? And Potapada replied to say, I don't understand either about whether the world is eternal or not, or whether the Tathagata exists after death or not, or both or neither. But the ascetic Gotama teaches a true and real way of practice, which is consonant with Dhamma and grounded in Dhamma. And why should not a man like me express approval of such a true and real practice, so well taught by the ascetic Gotama? That's an interesting little point there. Because the Buddha, what he did teach, was something you could grasp and understand as a true way. He didn't go into sort of this weird stuff, which, you know, people would like to talk about, but which you can't really sort of tie down. So what Potapada was very impressed with was what the Buddha did explain, made sense, and was comprehensible. And that's what impressed him. Now, I'm going to finish here, but just to go back to one of these, why the Buddha didn't declare these things, and especially paragraph 27. Does the Tathagata exist after death? I thought that the Buddha is supposed to cease, supposed to not exist after death. Isn't that the point of cessation? Ending samsara, no more being. Can you say the Tathagata does not exist after death? Both exists and not exists, or neither exists nor not exists? And the answer to that was in a beautiful sutta where this was asked of Venerable Sariputta. And Venerable Sariputta says, well, you know, the Tathagata right now, you know, what is the Tathagata right now? Now, is this Tathagata, this Buddha you see here, is it the body? Is that the Buddha? So, no, it's not the Buddha. Is it the Vedana, you know, the feelings he has? Is that who he is? No, that's not who he is. Is it the perception? Is that what the Buddha is? Is it the Sankhara, including the will? Is that what the Buddha is? No, that's not the Buddha. Is it the consciousness? Is that the Buddha? These are the five khandhas. They're saying, is either one of these the Buddha? No. All of these ones taken together, is that the Buddha? No, because these things come and go. They can't be the Buddha. Is there something apart from the five khandhas of the Buddha? No, there's only the five khandhas. And then Sariputta says, well, you can't even see the Buddha now. So what are you saying, that something gets annihilated at death and doesn't exist? This is the reason why the Buddha never answers that question. Because does the Tathagata exist after death or not exist after death? It doesn't exist now. So the whole question is wrongly formulated. And so, in the end, Sariputta asked Udayana, well, if someone asks you that question now, what would be the right answer? And the right answer, according to Sariputta, because Udayana gave the right answer, the Buddha, yes. He said, right now the Tathagata, or even you, there's just five khandhas arising and passing away. At the Parinibbana, they passed away, they don't arise again. That's how you answer that question. It's a very lovely. Okay. So, from the very beginning. Okay, just so the right answer is that you can't see a Tathagata, all you can see is five khandhas arising and passing away. That's all there ever was. And now they've arisen, they've passed away, and they're not arising again. They've ceased. So that's how you answer the question. Does a person exist after Nibbana or not exist after Nibbana? So they never really existed before. There were just five khandhas arising and passing away. They've arisen, they've passed away, not to arise again. So it's a different way of perceiving, where one perception passes away and another one arises. So that's why he didn't answer those questions, because, you know, they were wrong perceptions to begin with. You change the perception and then the answers come quite clear. Is the universe infinite or not infinite? You change your perception and see it just like using the simile of a football and an ant crawling on the surface. Change your perception and then it doesn't really make any sense. Is this universe infinite or not infinite? You're perceiving it in the wrong way. Pretty flat, but still, it's still pretty flat, but still enough bend in it to keep it limited size, but without any boundaries. It's not like. That's why they thought the earth was flat. They found it was bent. Then they found the universe, thought it was flat, and it's bent. And each one of you, you're not flat, you're bent too. Bendy Dhamma. Okay, so any question before we finish off? Because that's a nice time to finish off. Okay, we've got a question from overseas. Okay, we're going to carry on the next time I come here, which has been 2 weeks' time. Mary, why did you say just next week? Okay. So, yeah. So it is, the next one will be 2 weeks when I do part two of the Potapada Sutta. But first of all, we've got some questions from overseas. To show that our internet is working again. Oh, this is not from overseas. There's two of them from Perth. Okay. well, maybe just south of the river. At paragraph 17, the cessation is cessation of mind. Is this the end stage of a death process? No, because of the death process, the mind doesn't cease. It continues on. This is the end stage called parinibbana. And the after person dies, the consciousness continues, as Professor Pim van Lommel proved. And at paragraph 20, am I correct to read this as another application of the principle of Buddhist causality, not just being confined to explain dependent origination for rebirth? Where's paragraph 20 gone? See what paragraph 20 is. Oh. I used to paragraph 20, must be in here. Paragraph 20. Perception arises before knowledge. Buddhist causality? In a sense, yes. Causality applies all over in Buddhism, and especially here, the causality of some of the mental things in our world, and the causality of this particular thing called knowledge. So perception first, knowledge afterwards. So causality is not just it's not just dependent origination from birth. It's a causality which everything. The causality, like for example, just why do people lie? So I've given talks on that recently, that why do people lie? There must be a cause for it. Don't try and just make people afraid of lying. You know, they're going to get punished. So make it so that they are praised for telling the truth. Because a lot of times people lie because of fear. He will kill me if he found out how much I spent this afternoon on the computer using the credit card. That's why people lie. Because lying means they don't get into so much trouble. So if we can make it so whenever you lie, telling the truth is always less trouble, then people won't lie. So there's many causes and effects. So, you know, why do people rob banks? You know, don't try and just put them in jail and punish them. Try and find a cause for it. You know, like we were saying the other day, bullying. Why does bullying happen? You know, one of the causes is, say, like hierarchies. Whenever there's a hierarchy, you know, in offices, in military, even in monasteries, if there's any hierarchy, there will always be the opportunity for bullying. People with more power abusing their power to others. It doesn't always happen, but, you know, the less hierarchies we have, then the less bullying we will have. That also happens in schools. So that's the examples of cause and effect. And lastly, from Romania, I'm confused about avoiding the fire of the senses. Does it mean that a Buddhist must eat disgusting food, never listen to fire music, never listen to jokes or watch TV? No, please carry on listening to my jokes. You can ask. Avoiding the fire of the senses, they don't call that, they call restraining the senses. So, yes, okay to eat the food which you can digest, which is always a food you like. If you eat disgusting food, and I've done that enough in my life when I was in Thailand, so I've done my bit for disgusting food, and all it does, you can't digest it. Simply because disgusting food, saliva doesn't come out of the mouth, bile and this other stuff which digests food just doesn't get secreted. So it's obvious, you know, the cause for digestion is not there. It's got to taste good for it to be digested. Just simple cause and effect. So what we do, we restrain the senses so we don't pig out. You know, we don't keep watching the TV hour after hour after hour after hour. So, you know, it's okay, you know, you're lay people to watch a movie or to watch a documentary or something, fine. But it's not, that's restraining the senses rather than fighting the senses. So you don't need, you can listen to fine music, but don't do too much fine music. Do more meditation. So you can do that, but just middle way, restraint, so it doesn't obsess you. And that way eventually the senses, they don't run you. You don't have a soap opera. I've got to listen to this. I must listen to this. It's the final episode of whatever soap opera it is. So many people, they're owned by the TV by the TV guide runs their life. So don't be a person like that. I hope that's what you mean. So anyway, that's the talk for today, 4:30. I'm finishing on time for a change. So that's great. So we now pay respects to Buddha Dhamma Sangha, and then we can get ready to go and do what we need to do. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu.